It sort of bothered Linus that he had blown the chance to visit Spain, so he convinced himself that he would accept the next speaking invitation that came along. But he was having second thoughts as he lay in bed, wondering if he would ever overcome his fear of getting up in front of large groups of people, worrying that he would be unable to open his mouth, or worse, that he would lapse into giggles before the 400 members of the audience. He was a mess. Linus told himself the usual stuff, that the audience wanted him to succeed, that they wouldn't be there in the first place if they didn't like him, and that he certainly knew the topic, the reasons behind the various technical decisions in the writing of the Linux kernel, the reasons for making it open source. Still, he was unconvinced that the speech would be a success, and his mind chugged along like an unstoppable freight train engine. He literally was shaking in bed, and the frigid air was the least of it. The speech? Well, the audience was sympathetic to the obviously frightened Saul standing before them, clinging to his PowerPoint slides, thank God for Microsoft, like a life preserver, and then haltingly answering their questions. Actually, the question and answer session was the best part. After his speech, such as it was, Marshall Kirk McCusick, who was instrumental in BSD Unix, came up to Linus and told him he found his speech interesting. Linus was so grateful for the gesture, he felt like getting down on his knees and kissing McCusick's feet. There are few people Linus looks up to in computers, and Kirk is one of them. That first speech was like shock treatment. So were the ones that followed. But they started making Linus more self-confident. In the fall of 1992, he had been made a teaching assistant for Swedish language classes in the computer sciences department. At first, he was afraid to even go up to the blackboard and work on problems, but it didn't take long for him to just concentrate on the material and not worry about embarrassing himself. 3 years later, Linus was promoted to research assistant, which meant that instead of getting paid for teaching, he was paid to work in the computer lab, which mostly meant doing development work on Linux. It was the start of a trend, having someone else pay him to do Linux. That's basically what happens at Transmeta. It started becoming more of a deal when it became clear how many people depend on Linux as something other than a toy operating system. When they started using it for more than just tinkering around, Linus realized that if something goes wrong, he's responsible. Or at least he started feeling responsible. He still does. During 1992, the operating system graduated from being mostly a game to something that had become integral to people's lives, their livelihoods, commerce. The shift occurred in the spring of 1992, about a year after Linus had started terminal emulation, when the first version of the X windowing system ran under Linux. That meant the operating system was capable of supporting a graphical user interface, and that users could work in multiple windows simultaneously, thanks to the X-Windowing project, which had its origins at MIT. A hacker named Orst Zborowski was able to port X to Linux. The way the X-Window system works is by way of the X-Server, which does all the graphics. The server talks to the clients, which are the things that say, I want a window, and I want it this big. The communication goes through a layer called sockets, or, more formally, Unix domain sockets. It's how you communicate internally in Unix, but you also use sockets to communicate over the Internet. Orst wrote the first socket layer for Linux just to port X to it. His socket interface was kind of tacked on and not integrated with the other code. Linus agreed to the patch because Linux needed it, even though it was fairly raw. It took Linus a while to get used to the notion that he had a graphical user interface. He didn't use it on a daily basis for the first year or so, and these days he says he can't live without it. There are always tons of windows up when Linus works. Orst's contribution not only enabled Linux to have windows, but it also opened a big door for the future. The domain sockets were used for the local networking that enables the X windowing system to operate. Linus realized he could build on those same sockets to enable Linux to make the major leap to external networking, to have the ability to link computers. Without networking, Linux was usable only for people who sat at home and used a modem to dial up somewhere, or who did everything locally. With great optimism, people started developing Linux networking on top of those original sockets, even though they hadn't been meant for networking at all. Linus was so confident that they could easily do it that he made a leap in the version numbering scheme. In March 1992, he had planned to release version 0.13. Instead, with a graphical user interface in place, he felt confident that he and his contributors were maybe 95% of the way to their goal of releasing a full-fledged, reliable operating system, and one with networking. So he named the new release version 0.95. Boy, was he premature, not to mention clueless. Networking is nasty business, and it ended up taking almost exactly 2 years to get it right, to a form where it could be released. When you add networking, you suddenly introduce a host of new issues. There are security issues. You don't know who's out there and what they want to do. You have to be really careful that people don't crash your machine by sending it bad junk packets. You're not in control of who's trying to contact your machine anymore. By the end of 1993, the system had an almost usable networking capability, although some people had serious problems getting it to work. It couldn't handle networks that didn't have 8-bit boundaries. Because Linus had been overly optimistic in the naming of version 0.95, he was caught in a bind. Over the course of the 2 years it took to get version 1.0 out the door, he was forced to do some crazy things with numbers. There aren't many numbers between 95 and 100, but he continually released new versions based on bug fixes or added functions. By the time he got to version 0.99, he had to start adding numbers to indicate patch levels, and then he relied on the alphabet. At one point, he had version 0.99, patch level 15A, then version 0.99, patch level 15B, and so on. He made it all the way to patch level 15Z. Patch level 16 became version 1.0, the point where it was usable. This was released in March 1994 with great fanfare at the University of Helsinki Computer Sciences Department Auditorium. The period leading up to it had been kind of chaotic, but nothing could put a dent in Linux's popularity. Linux users had their own internet news group, comp.os.linux, and it was attracting hordes. Back then, the internet cabal, the folks who more or less ran the internet, kept unofficial monthly statistics on how many readers each newsgroup attracted. They weren't reliable statistics, but they were the best information available on the popularity of your site. In this case, how many people were interested in Linux. With the cabal's monthly statistics, Linus could easily track the popularity of comp.os.linux. And trust me, he kept track. While Linus might be somebody's idea of a folk hero, he's never been the selfless, ego-free, techno-love child the hallucinating press insists he is. By the fall of 1992, the estimates for the Linux newsgroup were on the order of tens of thousands of people. That many people followed the newsgroup to see what was going on, but they weren't all using Linux. Every month, when the stats came out, there was a summary report of the 40 most popular newsgroups. If your newsgroup didn't make it to the top 40, you could fetch the full report on other newsgroups' popularity from a special maintenance newsgroup. Usually, Linus had to go find the full report. The Linux newsgroup kept creeping up the chart. At one point, it made the top 40, and Linus was happy. He remembers having written a fairly gloating article to comp.os.linux in which he basically listed the various operating system newsgroups, including Minix, and said, "Hey, look at this! We're more popular than Windows!" Remember that, back then, people who liked Windows were not on the internet. Linux made it to the top 5 sometime in 1993. Linus went to bed that night brimming with self-satisfaction, excited by the fact that Linux had become almost as popular as the sex newsgroups. There certainly was no such matchup in his own little corner of the world. He says he truly did not have a life. By this time, Peter Anvin had organized an online collection that generated $3,000 in donations to help Linus pay off his computer, which he did at the end of 1993. And for Christmas, he upgraded to a 486 DX266, which he used for many years. But this was his life. He ate, he slept, maybe he went to university, he coded, he read a lot of email. The speech in Ada almost convinced Linus that he could survive anything, even something as terrifying as standing up before a group of total strangers and being the focus of their attention. His confidence was slowly building in other areas, too. He was being forced to make quick decisions regarding Linux fixes and upgrades, and with each decision, he felt increasingly comfortable in his role as leader of a growing community. The technical decisions had never been a problem. The problem was figuring out how to tell one person that he preferred another's suggested changes, and being diplomatic about it. Sometimes it was as simple as saying, "So-and-so's fixes are working fine. Why don't we just go with those?" Linus never saw the point of accepting anything other than what he thought was the best technical solution being presented. It was a way of keeping from taking sides when two or more programmers offered competing patches. Also, although he didn't think of it this way at the time, it was a way of getting people to trust him. And the trust compounds. When people trust you, they take your advice. Of course, you have to establish a foundation for all the trust. That started not so much when he wrote the Linux kernel as when he posted it to the internet, opening it up to anyone who wanted to join in and add the functions and details they liked, with Linus making ultimate decisions regarding the guts of the operating system. Just as he never planned for Linux to have a life outside his own computer, Linus also never planned to be the leader. It just happened by default. At some point, a core group of 5 developers started generating most of the activity in the key areas of development. It made sense for them to serve as the filters and hold the responsibility for maintaining those areas. Linus did learn fairly early that the best and most effective way to lead is by letting people do things because they want to do them, not because you want them to. The best leaders also know when they are wrong and are capable of pulling themselves out. And the best leaders enable others to make decisions for them. Linus says that much of Linux's success can be attributed to his own personality flaws. 1, he's lazy. And 2, he likes to get credit for the work of others. Otherwise, the Linux development model, if that's what people are calling it, would still be limited to daily email messages among a half dozen geeks, as opposed to an intricate web of hundreds of thousands of participants relying on mailing lists and developers' conventions and corporate sponsorship in maybe 4,000 projects that are taking place at any one time. At the top, arbitrating disputes over the operating system's kernel is a leader whose instinct is, and has always been, not to lead. And things work out for the best. Linus divested himself of things that didn't hold much interest for him. The first of these was the user level, the external parts of the system that end users deal with directly, as opposed to the deep-down, internal code. First, somebody volunteers to maintain it. Then the process for maintaining all the subsystems becomes organic. People know who has been active and who they can trust, and it just happens. No voting, no orders, no recounts. If 2 people are maintaining similar kinds of software drivers, for example, Linus will sometimes accept the work from both of them and see which one ends up getting used. Users tend to lean on one version versus the other. Or sometimes they end up evolving in different directions and their contributions end up having very distinct uses. What astonishes so many people is that the open source model actually works. It helps to understand the mentality of hackers in the free software universe. By the way, Linus usually tries to avoid the term hacker. In personal conversations with technical people, he sometimes calls himself a hacker, but lately the term has come to mean something else. Underage kids who have nothing better to do than sit around electronically breaking into corporate data centers when they should be out volunteering at their local libraries, or at the very least getting themselves laid. The hackers slash programmers working on Linux and other open source projects forgo sleep, Stairmaster workouts, their kids' Little League games, and yes, occasionally sex, because they love programming, and they love being part of a global collaborative effort. Linux is the world's largest collaborative project, dedicated to building the best and most beautiful technology that is available to anyone who wants it. It's that simple, and it's fun. Open source hackers aren't the high-tech counterparts of Mother Teresa. They do get their names associated with their contributions in the form of the credit list or history file that is attached to each project. The most prolific contributors attract the attention of employers who troll the code, hoping to spot and hire top programmers. Hackers are also motivated, in large part, by the esteem they can gain in the eyes of their peers by making solid contributions. It's a significant motivating factor. Everybody wants to impress their peers, improve their reputation, elevate their social status. Open source development gives programmers the chance. Linus was spending most of the year 1993 like he had spent most of 1992, 1991, etc., hunched over a computer. That was about to change. Following in the academic footsteps of his grandfather, Linus was a teaching assistant at the University of Helsinki, assigned to the fall semester of the Swedish language Introduction to Computer Sciences course. That's how he met Tuva. Tuva was one of 15 students in his course. She had already received a degree in preschool education. She wanted to study computers, too, but wasn't progressing as quickly as the rest of the class. She eventually caught up. The course was so basic, this was the fall of 1993, before the popularity of the internet. The homework assignment for the class one day was to send Linus email. It sounds absurd today, but he said, "For homework, send me email." Other students' emails contained simple test messages or unmemorable notes about the class. Tuva asked him out for a date. Linus married the first woman to approach him electronically. Their first date never ended. Tuva was a preschool teacher and six-time Finnish karate champion who had emerged from a functional family, although that's how Linus would describe any family that was not as quirky as his. She had a lot of friends. She felt like the right woman to Linus from the very first moment they got together. Within a few months, Linus and his cat Randy had moved into her minuscule apartment. For the first 2 weeks, Linus didn't even bother bringing over his computer. Not counting his army service, those 2 weeks were the longest span of time that he had spent away from a computer since he was 11 years old and sitting on his grandfather's lap. It still holds the record for being his biggest stretch as a civilian without a CPU. Somehow he managed. His mother, the few times he saw her then, would mutter something about a triumph of Mother Nature. Linus thinks his sister and father were just stunned. Soon, Tuva went out and got a cat to keep Randy company. Then the couple settled into a nice pattern of spending evenings alone or with friends, waking up at 5 a.m., so she could get to her job and Linus could get to the university early, before anyone would be there to disturb him, and read his Linux email. The birth of version 1.0 meant something new for Linux, the need for public relations. Linus would have been just as happy to introduce the new version to the world pretty much the way he had introduced previous versions. He would write something on the newsgroup like, "Version 1.0 is out, deal with it." Okay, not in those exact words. A lot of other people thought it was much more of a big deal. They wanted version 1.0 for marketing purposes. There were all these budding commercial companies that had started to sell Linux. To them, version 1.0 was important for psychological, not technical, reasons. Linus couldn't disagree. The fact is, it looks bad when you try and sell version 0.96 of an operating system. Linus wanted it out because it was a milestone for him, and because it meant he could stop fixing bugs for a while and go back to development. The companies and the Linux community wanted to foist it onto the public in a major way. They needed a public relations strategy. Linus wasn't going to personally champion the effort. He wasn't interested in putting out press releases or making statements. Others thought it should be done that way, so others volunteered to pick up the torch. This was pretty much how Linux itself was done, and somehow it all actually worked. Lars Vrzenius was one of the driving forces behind making the first official release a real event. He and a few others thought the university would be the most appropriate place to make the announcement. It made sense. Linus's bedroom was too small, and it would have set a wrong precedent to host the announcement at a commercial site. So Lars volunteered to coordinate the event with the university. The computer sciences department at the University of Helsinki was small enough that he could just talk to the head of the department. The University of Helsinki was more than happy to offer up the main auditorium of the computer sciences department for the introduction of Linux version 1.0. And why not? How often does a university have anything worthy of television news? Linus did agree to give a talk, but it bore none of the horror of his EDE experience. Well, some things were harder, he remembers, like having his dad in the audience, and the fact that it was on Finnish TV. It was the first time Linus ever got the chance to see himself on television. Both of his parents were in the audience. He's fairly certain they weren't sitting together. Tuva was there too. It was the first time his dad met Tuva. So for Linus, it was more than just the announcement of version 1.0. Since he was involved in last-minute speech preparations, like making sure his slides were okay, he wasn't there when they actually met. That apparently happened when they were walking into the auditorium. He may have caught it out of the corner of his eye. In that talk, and in virtually every other one over the next several years, Linus spoke not so much about the technology, but about open source. It was nice. It changed some opinions about Linux inside the computer science department. Before that, Linux was something the computer science department was proud of and mildly encouraged. But after the announcement, people within the department started taking Linux more seriously. After all, they had seen it on the news. Over the years, some have suggested that the university was trying to take credit for Linux. That wasn't the case. The department had always been very supportive. They even gave Linus a job that enabled him to work on Linux on their time. And that was in the early days, so nobody was saying, let's push this because someday it will be world famous. But at the same time, they were pleased to be a big part of the announcement. It provided great public relations. There are now more Swedish-speaking students in the computer sciences department, which had always been overshadowed by the Polytechnic University. Success envy is considered a Finnish cultural characteristic. And as Linux became better known in the world at large, Linus got a lot of questions about whether he had problems with people at the university being envious of him. The opposite turned out to be true. They were very supportive. Early on, they started getting rid of X-terminals and installing PCs with Linux instead. The announcement launched Linux into the above-the-radar zone in Finland, and it started generating publicity elsewhere too. A lot of the early headlines came about because some journalists had stumbled over Linux and got excited about it. From a business standpoint, version 1.0 was never very challenging to any of the big players. Linux was getting the market that Minix and Coherent had, but there was little attention outside that community, which was fine. It was far more attention than Linus had expected initially. Regardless, journalists, mostly from trade publications, started knocking at Linus's door. Literally. It didn't make Tuva happy to wake up on a Saturday morning to find a Japanese reporter bearing gifts, usually watches, as they probably heard somewhere that he had a thing for them, and wanting to do an interview. It made her even less happy when Linus would invite them in. And it wasn't only journalists or Linux hacker types who were showing an interest. Suddenly, people with big expense accounts wanted to talk to Linus about their technology. Unix had long been seen as an operating system with vast potential, mostly because of its power and multitasking capabilities. So corporations that were interested in Unix started keeping an eye on Linux. One of those was the networking company Novell, which had started a Skunkworks project based on Linux. It was a Unix desktop they evolved called Looking Glass. It looked nice, but it was up against a wall. It lacked the standard of the time, which was the common desktop environment. In August 1994, they said they wanted to pay Linus to visit them in Orem, Utah, to talk to them about their desktop. Novell was offering Linus his big chance to see America, so he told them he would accept if they would pay for him to visit another U.S. city. They suggested New York, but he thought it would be more interesting to go to California. Inside Novell's headquarters, it was hard to determine just how serious people were about the project. In the end, they ended up being not very serious at all. They eventually killed the project, and the 9 people involved started up Caldera. But Linus was getting his first taste of the United States, where he figured he would live at some point in his life. After Utah, he flew to San Francisco and really, really liked it. He spent so much time walking around the city that he developed a major case of sunburn and had to remain indoors for an entire day. Linus remembers walking across the Golden Gate Bridge, looking up at the Marin Headlands, excited about the possibility of hiking in those hills as soon as he crossed the bridge. But by the time he made it to the Marin side, he had lost all interest in walking anymore. He could never have predicted that 6 years later, almost to the day, he would be sitting at the crest of those windy headlands, looking out on the Pacific Ocean, San Francisco Bay, the bridge, the fog, and San Francisco itself, explaining all this to my tape recorder. It would take only a year for Linus to return to the United States. He came back to speak to Dekus, Digital's user group in New Orleans. There were only 40 people at the meeting, so it wasn't a terrible ordeal. Best of all, that's when he met Mad Dog, a.k.a. John Hall. He was a technical marketing person for Digital Unix and an old-time Unix user. He was responsible for sending Linus over for the talk. Mad Dog, who is known for his chest-length beard and his absurd sense of humor, not to mention his propensity to snore, heads Linux International, an organization that works to support Linux and Linux users. He's also a godfather to Linus's daughter, Patricia. Another legacy of that New Orleans meeting? Mad Dog arranged for Digital to lend Linus an Alpha. That's how Linux got ported to something other than a PC. Before that time, people had ported Linux to other architectures. There was a port to a 68K, the Motorola 68000 machines used by Atari and Amiga, but in those cases, Linux didn't work on both platforms at the same time. To make that version of scaling work, you rip out the pieces that don't work on the new platform and you write new pieces, but the Alpha was the first real port of Linux. Basically, the same sources worked on both the PC and Alpha. You add an abstraction layer so that the same code gets compiled in 2 different ways to work on 2 different architectures. It's still the same code, but it ends up working on different architectures. When Linus released version 1.2 in March 1995, the kernel had grown to include 250,000 lines of code. The new magazine Linux Journal claimed a 10,000 reader circulation. And Linux was capable of running on Intel, Digital, and SunSpark processors. That was a big step. It's 1995, and there is a host of growing commercial versions, and Linux companies are attracting a strong following. The university has elevated Linus from a teaching assistant to a research assistant, which means more money and less time teaching. He's slowly, very slowly, completing the coursework for his master's degree, which is about porting Linux to different architectures. Tuva has introduced him to Squash, and they have a weekly game. They're fairly evenly matched. From this bliss, a problem emerges. It turns out that an opportunistic fellow from Boston has registered the trademark for the word Linux. Not only that, but he sent email to the Linux Journal and a few other Linux companies asking for 5% of their revenues as a thank you for the trademark. When he heard about this, Linus felt a twinge of deja vu. The guy's name sounded familiar. He checked his email archives and saw that, maybe a year and a half earlier, the fellow had sent Linus an unsolicited email in which he first asked if Linus believed in God, and then said he was offering a tremendous business opportunity. This was before spamming became a global obsession. The innocent years before anyone thought to pollute the internet with offers of get-rich-quick schemes. No, Linus hadn't bothered responding to the fellow's email, but because it was so unusual for its time, he saved it. So the Linux team had a little crisis on their hands. They were hackers. Nobody thought about checking the trademark register. The guy wasn't a professional trademark squatter. He apparently just did it this one time. Trademarks come in different categories, and he registered his in the computer category. You have to submit evidence with your trademark application, so he gave the trademark office a disk on which he claimed to have a program called Linux. There was some panic. Everybody in the Linux community knew they would contest the trademark. The problem was, they didn't have an organization for putting up a good fight. There wasn't even enough money to hire a lawyer. None of the companies felt comfortable about laying down the required amount, which was $15,000. Today they go through that in a month's worth of Mountain Dew. But at the time, it was a considerable amount of money for a single company. So Linux Journal and some other companies decided to pump money into Linux International, which would fight the trademark. Linux International had been started in Australia by a person named Patrick DeCruz, who migrated to the United States in 1994 to help promote Linux worldwide. The year of the trademark dispute was the year when Mad Dog became its executive director. Everybody trusted him, and still does. Linus was in Finland, trying to beat Tuva in squash, and he had no interest in getting involved in this. He just wanted the entire nightmare to go away. His preference at the time was to just get rid of the trademark, to get it declared invalid because of prior use in the industry. The Linux companies had enough paperwork to show that Linux had, in fact, a history of prior use. The trouble was, their lawyer convinced them that it would be a wasted effort, that they should not even try to get Linux declared a public domain instead of a trademark. The only way for it to really be in the public domain, he explained, was for it to become generic. And Linux at the time wasn't that generic. The trademark office probably wouldn't even consider it to be generic today. They could lose the battle, he said, or if they invalidated the old trademark, somebody could possibly come along and trademark it anew. The solution he suggested was to transfer the trademark to somebody else. Linus's vote went to Linux International, but there was a lot of opposition to that. Linux International was young and unproven. People were worried about Linux International being taken over by commercial interests. It hasn't happened. There was also strong concern about who would eventually take over for Mad Dog if he were to step down. So all eyes looked to Linus. The lawyer suggested that the legal arguments would be easier if the Linux trademark were to be transferred to Linus because he was the original user of the word. That's the strategy the Linux team took. They reached an out-of-court settlement because that seemed like the easiest and cheapest thing to do. Like most out-of-court settlements, the details can't be discussed. Not that Linus even knows them. He was happily uninterested in it all. When Linus went back to check his original email from the guy, he realized that it had nothing to do with patents. It was obvious that he just wanted to talk to Linus. Maybe he tried to contact Linus to get him to pay him, or maybe if Linus had shown himself to be a true believer and soul brother in his faith, he would have just given Linus the trademark. Who knows? Some people are not morally all there, but what was more irritating to Linus at the time was the fact that the entire trademark system put this onus on him, who had done nothing wrong, to go out and fight the guy. As a result of the messy skirmish, Linus holds the Linux trademark. What that means is, when companies like VA Linux file for an IPO, their prospectus has to mention the fact that the company doesn't even own the trademark for half of its name. In that particular case, the company was involved in the legal process of getting approval from Linus to use the word Linux. But he's gotten accustomed to that sort of thing. The trademark episode was just an unexpected growing pain for Linux, and a distraction. But no sooner was it settled than another surfaced. An engineer at Intel's research lab in Portland, Oregon, said his company was using Linux in its exploration of new architectures. He asked Linus if he wanted to move there for a 6-month internship. Tuva and Linus had spoken in vague terms about possibly living in the United States. She knew how much he had enjoyed his few visits there. They agreed that the opportunities, not to mention the climate, were better in America. By the way, Linus is totally convinced that the U.S. system of motivating employees is far more realistic and produces better results than the European model. In Finland, if a worker is much better than his colleagues, you give him just a little more money and keep it very quiet. In America, you give him a lot more money, and it works. The internship seemed like a great way of testing the waters, or, since it was in the Pacific Northwest, the rainwaters. And Linus and Tuva agreed that he should pursue the opportunity. But he was ambivalent. He felt a bit uneasy about leaving school without having finished his master's. Something inside him, possibly the memory of his professor grandfather, didn't take to the notion of being a dropout. In the end, his feelings didn't even matter. The engineer's manager decided that it would be difficult for him to obtain the required 6-month work permit from the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service for the internship. So they stayed in Helsinki. By the time Finland's legendary revelers were toasting the arrival of New Year's Day 1996, Linus was inching toward the master's degree finish line. He only needed to complete one small course to finish the credit requirements, and he also had to write his thesis. Ironically, it would be the first time he got any academic credit for his work on Linux, which had consumed most of his life throughout his college years. My 10-year-old daughter Kaylee thinks it's the apex of superstardom to have someone buy you a penguin. We are sitting around a campfire on a clear Sierra night when Linus explains that a Linux users group in Bristol, England, bought him a penguin. Kaylee cannot imagine that he hasn't bothered to visit the creature. Then he elaborates. Actually, they didn't buy him a penguin, but instead sponsored one in his name. And the sponsorship lasts for a year, he thinks. The Torvalds family is trying to understand the concept behind s'mores. Somebody looks up from his roasted marshmallow and makes the mistake of asking how the penguin came about as the planetary symbol of Linux in the first place. The penguin was my idea, says Tuva. Linus was trying to find a symbol for Linux because people were asking, shouldn't there be a symbol? I thought about penguins. Linus had been bitten by a fairy penguin at a zoo in Australia. He likes to pet things. He's always poking at stuff like rattlesnakes. Those penguins at the zoo were about 1 foot high, and he just reached into the cage to pet one of them. He kind of played with his fingers as if they were fish. The penguin came at him, bit him, noticed he was not a fish. He got bitten by a penguin, but he liked it anyway. I got the feeling he was sold on penguins after that. He wanted to see penguins wherever it was possible. The story, according to Linus, is that while Tuva may, in fact, have vaguely mentioned penguins at some early stage, it was in a conversation with two high-ranking Linux types that the icy creatures were first seriously considered as the operating system's official mascot. Tuva has her take on this version. We were in Boston meeting with Mad Dog and Henry Hall, she says. They started talking about the symbol. I said to them, what about a penguin? Do you think it's nice? They said yes. I think that made Linus think it might be a good idea after all. Henry Hall said he knew an artist who could draw it for him, but that never happened. The next thing I knew, Linus had asked on the internet if there were people who wanted to send in pictures of penguins. Linus chose a version by Larry Ewing, a graphic artist who works at the Institute for Scientific Computing at Texas A&M University. But this wasn't to be just any penguin. Above all, Linus wanted one that looked happy, as if it had just polished off a pitcher of beer and then had the best sex of its life. Even beyond that stipulation, he wanted one that was distinct. Hence, while all other penguins have black beaks and feet, those features are orange on the Linux mascot, making it look almost like a penguin whose father was a duck. As if Daffy Duck got a little quasi on a cruise to Antarctica and had a wild one-night stand with some native fowl. News of Linus's decision to work for Transmeta Corporation was greeted with the same reaction in the Linux community as was the news that he and Tuva had figured out how to conceive a child and were expecting one at the end of 1996. When word leaked out in the spring that Tuva was pregnant, the more vocal among Linux user newsgroup participants wanted to know how Linus planned on balancing the demands of Linux maintenance with those of a family. A few months later, when it became known that Linus would finally be leaving the University of Helsinki to work for the secretive Transmeta in Silicon Valley, the big worldly debate centered on whether he could possibly keep true to his open source philosophy in a dreaded commercial environment as opposed to a neutral academic institution. Transmeta was partly funded by Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen, folks declared in protest. Some claimed it must be an elaborate scam for taking control of Linux. The fact is, neither the birth of Patrizia in December 1996, and Daniela 16 months later, and Celesta 48 months later, nor his job at Transmeta, which began in February 1997, has caused the downfall of Linux. Linus felt, all along, that if anything were to negatively affect his work with Linux, he would have taken the obvious necessary step of turning it all over to somebody he trusts. In the spring of 1996, just as the weather was breaking, Linus finished the last of his required coursework for his master's. It was about this time that he heard from Peter Andvin, the Linux community member who 3 years earlier had organized the online collection that helped Linus pay off his first PC. Like everybody else who prowled the Linux newsgroups, Peter knew Linus would soon be graduating. He had been working at Transmeta for about a year and approached his boss to explain that he knew this guy in Finland who might be good for the company. Peter came to meet with Linus briefly while he was visiting his mother in Sweden. He talked up Transmeta, which was pretty hard to do since it was in stealth mode and he couldn't tell Linus much of anything. The rumor among programmers was only that it was involved in developing programmable chips. A week after Peter returned to California, he sent Linus an email asking when he could come. This was hugely different from the experience Linus had had with Intel a year earlier, when an engineer wanted to hire him for an internship, but it never happened because of the paperwork issues. It would be fun just to get a trip to California, Linus thought. This was the first job interview of his life. He didn't have a resume. He didn't know what Transmeta was doing. It was in a strange land. Linus was more worried about the implications of moving to the United States than about getting the job itself, so he didn't even think of the meetings as being interviews. What mattered more, it seemed to Linus, was to learn what these guys were up to. It was a fairly strange interview situation. After the first day, Linus went back to his hotel across the street from Transmeta's Office Park headquarters. In his jet-lagged state, he thought it was all interesting, but he also thought that the folks at Transmeta were crazy. At that point, the company didn't have any silicon at all. No hardware. Everything was done with a simulator, and the demonstration of the simulation booting into Windows 3.11 and running Solitaire did little to convince Linus that anything was going to happen. After that first day, he wondered if it wasn't all a waste. He distinctly remembers thinking, maybe this isn't going to turn out, either as a technological innovation for Transmeta or a job. Linus literally slept on it. Actually, it wasn't much of a sleep. He lay in bed thinking about Transmeta's plans. Then he started fantasizing about having a backyard palm tree. Then he started ruminating over what he had seen on the simulator. It was a memorable, fitful night. By morning, he was somewhat excited. By the end of the second day, he was very excited. That's when the stress began. Before accepting Transmeta's offer, Linus talked it over with various people. When word got out that he was considering the job, he received a number of other offers. In Finland, he got an offer from Tele, the phone company, which was using Linux in some capacity. Through Mad Dog, he got an offer at Digital. He talked to some of the Red Hat people. They offered him a job and said they would pay better than Transmeta was paying, even though they had no idea what the proposed salary was because he hadn't even discussed money with the company. The Red Hat crowd said they would even top Transmeta's stock options, whatever they would be. But Linus wasn't interested in working for any particular Linux company, even one that was fortunate enough to be located in the middle of North Carolina. In the end, Linus got 5 job offers without ever formally looking for a job. Transmeta's was the most exciting by far. He said yes. It felt weird, Linus says. The next thing he did was tell the university he would be leaving. That's when the stress really began. For him, it was a giant step that meant there was no turning back. He and Duva were having a new child, moving to a new country, and he was leaving the safe nest of the University of Helsinki after writing his thesis. It was madness. There was no formal announcement. Why should there be? Just words circulating on the internet and the aforementioned debate about whether Linus would be able to remain true to Linux and free software in the evil corporate environment and between the changing of diapers. Back then, people had this view of Linux as something that was mainly developed by university students, not settled down people. It was understandable that they would be nervous. Linus wrote his thesis over a long weekend and turned it in minutes before taking Tuva to the hospital to deliver Patricia, who was born 40 hours later. That was December 5th, 1996. The next several weeks, Linus and Tuva were busy with Patricia and constantly worrying about obtaining the approvals for their U.S. visa paperwork, which was taking forever. They figured it would help if they were married, so sometime in January, Linus always has to ask Tuva the date, they went to a government office to be officially wed. To say goodbye to all of their friends, they hosted a house cooling party, the reverse of a housewarming. 20 people crammed into the small, recently emptied one-bedroom apartment. In good, Finnish tradition, everybody got drunk. Their visas finally arrived, and on February 17, 1997, they boarded a morning flight to San Francisco. They landed in the United States and made their way through customs carrying a baby and 2 cats. Peter Anvin was there to greet them as they rented a car for the drive down to Santa Clara to the apartment complex they had chosen during an apartment hunting trip they had taken a few months earlier. Linus says it all felt surreal, particularly the 70-degree difference in climate from Finland. With the move and getting accustomed to the new job at Transmeta, Linus didn't have a lot of time to devote to Linux during those first couple of months. The new job occupied much of his time, and his after-work hours were spent with Tuva and Patricia, trying to get to know the new area. It was a fairly busy time. They had absolutely no money. Linus had this great salary, but everything went toward getting furniture. Buying a car was a hassle because they had no way of establishing a credit history. They even endured hassles proving they were capable of paying for telephone service. Linus's computer was on a ship that was inching its way around the Horn of Africa. It was the first period of time when he was quiet on the web, and his absence worried a lot of people. It was like, okay, now he's working for a commercial company. Many people asked outright, does this mean Linux will die off as a free system? Linus explained that under his agreement with Transmeta, he could continue doing Linux, and that he wasn't going to go away. He couldn't think of a way to say that he was just catching his breath. Life in Transmeta Land. One of the problems with explaining to people how the move to the States and into the commercial world wasn't going to change him was the fact that Transmeta was just about the most secretive company around. There was only one rule concerning what you could talk about, and that rule was very simple, say nothing. Which just made Linux people sometimes wonder what kind of strange cult Linus had joined, and whether he was ever coming back. What he was doing at Transmeta wasn't all that strange. The first thing he actually ended up doing was fixing some of the Linux problems that Transmeta had. The company was using a lot of multiprocessor Linux machines. Linus had never personally worked on the Linux SMP, or symmetric multiprocessing, issues, and it turned out that many things didn't really work the way they were supposed to. He took this as a personal affront, and he had to fix it, of course. Transmeta does more than just hardware, which is just as well because, Linus says, he wouldn't know a transistor from a diode, even if one kicked him in the head. What Transmeta does is simple hardware that relies on clever software to make a simple CPU look like much more than it really is, like a standard Intel-compatible 086, in fact. And with the hardware being made smaller and simpler, the CPU ends up having fewer transistors, which in turn makes it use less power, which, as everybody realizes, will become increasingly more important in a mobile world. This clever software is why Transmeta has a rather large software team, and why Linus was there. This all fit him quite well, a non-Linux company that did something that was technically quite interesting. Understatement of the year. He didn't know of another company that had ever seriously even tried to do what Transmeta does. And it was in an area that he knew intimately, low-level programming of the quite esoteric 80x86 family of CPUs. As you undoubtedly recall, it was the act of getting to know that CPU in the first personal computer Linus owned that had started the whole Linux project in the first place. The fact that Transmeta wasn't a Linux company was also important to him. Linus loved fixing Linux problems at Transmeta, and he's been involved in several internal projects about Linux. In fact, these days it's probably impossible to find a serious technology company without such projects. But at Transmeta, Linux was secondary, which was just what Linus wanted. He could continue to do Linux, but he didn't feel he would have to make the technical compromises that would favor the company's goals over Linux itself. He could continue to think of Linux as a hobby in which only technology mattered, and nothing else held sway over his decisions. So during the day, he worked for Transmeta. He wrote and maintained the 086 interpreter that is still in use today, although others maintain it now. The interpreter is basically the piece of Transmeta software that looks at Intel instructions one at a time and executes them. That is, it interprets the language of the 80086 architecture, one instruction at a time. Linus ended up doing other things later, but that's how he got into the strange and wonderful world of hardware emulation. During the night, he slept. Linus's deal with Transmeta was clear. He had been given assurances that he could work on Linux during work hours, too. He took full advantage of that. A lot of people believe in working long days and doing double, triple, or even quadruple shifts. Linus is not one of them. Neither Transmeta nor Linux has ever gotten in the way of a good night's sleep for Linus. Welcome to Silicon Valley. One of the first things Linus got to do upon landing in this strange galaxy was to meet the stars. He received an email from Steve Jobs' secretary about how he'd like to meet and could Linus spare an hour or two. Not knowing what it was all about, he said sure. The meeting was at Apple's headquarters on Infinity Loop Drive. It was with Jobs and his chief technical guy, Avi Tavanian. This was when Apple was starting work on OS X, the Unix-based operating system that wasn't released until September 2000. There wasn't much formality to the meeting. Basically, Jobs started off by trying to tell Linus that on the desktop there were just two players, Microsoft and Apple, and that he thought that the best thing Linus could do for Linux was to get in bed with Apple and try to get the open source people behind Mac OS X. Linus stuck around because he wanted to learn about the new operating system. It's based on Mach, the microkernel developed at Carnegie Mellon University. In the mid-1990s, the Mach was expected to be the ultimate operating system, and a lot of people were interested in it. In fact, IBM and Apple used Mach as the basis for their ill-fated Taligent joint venture operating system. Jobs made a big point of the fact that Mach's low-level kernel is open source. He sort of played down the flaw in the setup. Who cares if the basic operating system, the real low-core stuff, is open source if then you have the Mac layer on top, which is not open source? Avi Tavanian had been one of the Mach people when it was a university project. It was kind of interesting for Linus to discover what Tavanian and Steve saw as the issues. At the same time, they disagreed fairly fundamentally on technical matters. Linus really didn't think there was a reason for open source or Linux people to get involved. Sure, he could understand why they wanted to get more open-source developers into their system. They were seeing the momentum build behind Linux. But Linus didn't think they were seeing it quite enough. He didn't think Jobs realized that Linux would potentially have more users than Apple, although it's a very different user base. And he didn't think Steve would be quite as eager to dismiss Linux as a desktop system today as he was 3 years ago. Linus and Jobs had basic differences in how they viewed the world. Steve was Steve, exactly as the press portrays him. He was interested in his own goals, and especially the marketing side. Linus was interested in the technical side, and not very interested in either Jobs' goals or his arguments. Steve's main argument was that if Linus wanted to get the desktop market, he should come join forces with Apple. Linus's reaction was, "Why should I care? Why would I be interested in the Apple story?" He didn't think there was anything interesting in Apple, and his goal in life was not to take over the desktop market. Sure, it's going to happen, but it's never been his goal. Steve didn't use very many arguments. He just basically took it for granted that Linus would be interested. He was clueless, unable to imagine that there could be entire segments of the human race who weren't the least bit concerned about increasing the Mac's market share. He was truly surprised at how little Linus cared about how big a market the Mac had, or how big a market Microsoft has. But even though Linus disagreed with almost everything he said, he kind of liked him. In the spring of 1998, a third blonde entered Linus's world. Daniela Yolanda Torvalds got produced on April 16th, making her the first Torvalds to be a U.S. citizen. She and Patrizia are 16 months apart, the same as Linus and his sister Sarah. But Linus guarantees they won't be as embattled as his sister and he were growing up, certainly not with Tuva's moderating influence or her karate skills. 2 weeks before Daniela's birth, the open-source community got its biggest boost ever. That's when Netscape opened up the source code for its browser technology in a project named Mozilla. On the one hand, the news got everyone on the newsgroups excited because it raised the visibility of open-source. But it also made a lot of people, including Linus, fairly nervous. Netscape was in trouble at the time, thanks in large part to Microsoft, and the opening up of its browser was seen as a somewhat desperate measure. Ironically, the browser's roots were in open source. It began as a project at the University of Illinois. People on the newsgroups were expressing their fears that Netscape would muck things up and give open source a bad name. Now there would be two big-name open-source projects, Netscape and Linux, and the reasoning was that if Netscape, the better-known of the two, were to fail, the reputation would impact Linux, too. And, to a large degree, Netscape did fail. The company had trouble getting open-source developers interested in the project for the longest time. It was just a huge body of code, and the only people who could get into that code were Netscape people. The project was somewhat doomed, not only because of its size, but also because Netscape wasn't able to make everything available as open source. Only the development version, which was fairly broken at the time the company released it. The company couldn't GPL the browser because not all the code was theirs. The Java portion was licensed from Sun, for example. Not everyone on the newsgroups agreed with Netscape's license. On the whole, the license was fairly mellow, but if you're someone like Richard Stallman, you don't like mellow. Linus thought it was wonderful that Netscape took this step, but he didn't view it as a personal achievement. He remembers that Eric Raymond took it really personally. He was extremely happy about it. His paper, The Cathedral and the Bazaar, which did an excellent job of explaining the open source philosophy and history, had been released the year before and was cited as one of the reasons behind the Netscape decision. He was actively pushing open source. He had been at Netscape on a number of occasions, trying to convince them to open up their browser. Linus was there only once. In fact, Eric had visited a number of companies bearing the open source message. Linus was interested in the technology, not the evangelism. Linux people were all worried because Netscape had received a lot of news coverage, and for that first year, people walked on eggshells. Nobody wanted to say anything negative about Netscape for fear that it would result in bad press for open source and scare other companies away. But 2 months after Netscape's move, Sun Microsystems joined the game by declaring that it would become the first major hardware vendor to join Linux International. It would support Linux on its servers. The company had an unimpressive licensing scheme for its Genie project, but had decided that Linux was worth taking seriously. The news groups overflowed with self-congratulations. With Sun on board, Linux developments made their way from internet discussions to the trade press. Outsiders were now interested, but mostly technical outsiders. Then came IBM. IBM has been known for being fairly stodgy, so everybody was taken by surprise when the company announced in June that it would sell and support Apache, the most popular commercial Linux version used for web servers. You could run Apache on AIX, IBM's Unix, and that's probably what a lot of people who bought IBM did. That's how Apache got to IBM's attention. Somebody must have noticed that most of those server machines ended up using Apache, so they calculated that they would sell more servers if they had the in-house expertise to support such customers. Or maybe they were acting on feedback from customers who said they would buy IBM machines but would run Apache. It's relatively easy to install Linux on a computer, but for most companies, one of the big issues historically has been, who do we blame when something goes wrong? Obviously, there are Linux companies like Red Hat that provide the support, but it was a psychological advantage for customers to know that IBM would be there for them. When IBM started getting into open source, a lot of people suspected it was just lip service, but that turned out not to be the case. IBM dipped its toe in the water by running and supporting Linux on its server boxes, and then sort of waded all the way in. Next came the small PC servers, then the regular PCs, then the laptops. The company has announced it will spend $1 billion on Linux this year. There's no doubt that IBM was Linux's biggest coup, and it generated only excitement on the newsgroups, not the sort of paranoia provoked by the Netscape announcement, or any of the seething anti-commercialism that has periodically divided Linux enthusiasts. By July, Informix announced that it would port its databases to Linux, meaning that even if you used Linux to operate your computer, you could run an Informix database. It wasn't such a big deal at the time. The company had been having financial trouble, but it was still one of the top three database vendors. Linux people were mildly happy about the development and were writing self-congratulatory essays in Linux advocacy groups. Within weeks, from out of nowhere, Oracle followed suit. Oracle dominated databases. Long before the announcement, there had been rumors on the newsgroups about the company having some internal ports to Linux. And since Oracle is synonymous with Unix servers, it wasn't such a major leap to Linux. But if you followed the newsgroups, Linux had definitely entered the big time. The Oracle announcement had a huge psychological impact, even if its technical impact was zero. Like the IBM announcement before it, Oracle's big move was felt not only by the Linux community, but by the folks who are commonly referred to as management decision makers, although some people prefer the term suits. No longer would they be able to say they couldn't use Linux because their business depends on databases. Most of the activity was taking place at corporations. Technical people who had long known about Linux were being approached by their company's leaders who had been seeing articles about Linux in the trade press, or hearing about it. They would ask their technical folks what the fuss was all about. Then, once they learned the benefits, they would make the decision to have their servers run Linux. What tended to sway the suits were the simple technical arguments. Linux was stronger than the competition, which consisted of Windows NT and the various flavors of Unix. And importantly, people just hate having to do things the way Microsoft or anybody else says they have to do them. You can do things with Linux that you can't do with the competition. The original people who used Linux did so because they could get access to sources in ways they couldn't with commercial software. From that perspective, things hadn't changed much since Linus had released version 0.01 from his bedroom. Linux was more flexible than other systems out there. You got to be your own boss. And, at least in the case of web servers, it didn't contain the bloat, the many unnecessary features that make up competing operating systems. Another thing Linux had in its favor? Despite its growing popularity as an operating system for web servers, it really didn't occupy a niche. This is important as a way of understanding Linux's success. Mainframe computers were a niche. Unix in general was a series of niches. The U.S. Department of Defense supercomputer niche, the banking niche. The folks selling operating systems for mainframes and other big systems made money because they were charging a lot for their operating systems. Then Microsoft came along and charged $90. Microsoft didn't go after the banking niche or any other niche. But now it was everywhere. It was like getting invaded by locusts. It's hard to get rid of that kind of invasion. It's a lot better to be everywhere and take over every niche, and that's what Microsoft did. Think of a fluid organism that flows into any place it can find. If one niche is lost, it's not a big deal. The organism surrounds the world, flowing into anything that's interested. The same thing is happening with Linux today. It flows into anything that's interested. Linux doesn't have just one niche. It's small and flexible and finds its way into many places. You find it in supercomputers, at important places like the U.S. government's Fermilabs or NASA. But that's kind of an outflowing of the server space, which is an outflowing of the desktop space, which is where Linus got started. And at the same time, you'll find Linux in embedded devices, everything from anti-lock brakes to watches. Watch it flow. Meanwhile, there's a great advantage to grassroots. The best and the brightest of the next generation are using your product because you are the thing that makes that generation excited. In an earlier generation, it wasn't so much Microsoft and DOS, but PCs that got people excited. If you were into PCs, you were into DOS. There wasn't much choice, and that was a huge advantage for spreading Microsoft. If you look at the brightest young kids around, they're not all doing Linux, but a lot of them are. Sure, one of the reasons that the open source philosophy and Linux both have major followings in universities is simple. The anti-establishment sentiment. It's the big, evil Microsoft Corporation and wicked, greedy Bill Gates versus the "we're in it for the love and free software for everybody" and the self-effacing, seeming, folk hero Linus B. Torvalds thing. Those kids graduate and take jobs in corporations, where they bring with them their love for Linux. So folks who've ventured into the depths of Microsoft tell me they've seen Linus's face on dartboards. Linus's only comment, "How could anybody possibly miss my nose?" IBM's big announcement in the spring of 1998 was followed by similar announcements by every major hardware vendor. By August, Forbes magazine had discovered Linux's little world by putting a picture of Linus on the cover with the words, "Peace, Love, Software." As company after company made an inevitable commitment to Linux, you no longer had to peruse the advocacy newsgroups to read the tea leaves. Linux had captured the planet's heart like some improbable Olympic gold medalist from an unrecognizable third world nation. Linus was the poster boy. In a press interview, Eric Raymond explained that part of his appeal was that he was, quote, "less visibly odd than a lot of other hackers." Okay, that's one hacker's opinion. Not everybody liked the situation.